Okay, here we are for another edition of Mormon Land, the Salt Lake Tribune's weekly podcast about Mormon news and personalities, doctrine, people. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and here with David Noyce. He's the managing editor. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
And reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, good morning.
Hello.
Peggy, you are our guest of honor today. You recently spent several weeks in Asia, interviewing and observing how Mormons practice their faith in several countries. And we want to hear about some of your behind-the-scenes observations. You've published a couple of stories now, a couple more to come, but we'd love to get your perspective. First of all, why were you in Southeast Asia?
So I am on the board of the International Association of Religion Journalists, which looks at how religion is covered all over the world. And there was a conference in Jakarta, Indonesia. I was invited to be on a panel, to moderate another panel, and to talk about what it's like covering religion in especially these Muslim-dominant countries. Indonesia is the most populous Muslim nation in the world. And so it made sense to have a religion writing conference there. So while I was there, and oh my gosh, it was the most interesting conference ever. Because, you know, here I am, I write about in a place in the U.S. where we have one dominant faith, Mormonism. And in Indonesia, you know, and I get a lot of hate mail. I get lots of criticism for what I write about.
We call that fan mail.
For what I write about the dominant faith here. In other places in the world, you write critically about the dominant faith, you might be, you know, jailed or even killed. So it was pretty fascinating to meet colleagues in that setting who have to write about factions within Islam, about how people are treated.
I mean, because of that environment, does that shape the way that they report? I mean, do you have a filter? Are you super careful so that you don't end up in jail or worse?
I think some of the reporters that were at the conference, places like Pakistan, Malaysia, those are places where, yes, you would be self-censoring some, and the really bold ones would be in trouble. But Indonesia even though it's the most populous Muslim nation, it has a history of being more tolerant as a Muslim nation. In the when Indonesia became a country and had its institution, it got its independence in 1945, it was still a Muslim-dominated country, but as a group, they decided, well, the president decided that it would recognize five different faiths and not institute Sharia law, which is the Islamic law. So it's been this model of religious tolerance for all these decades, but now there seems to be a rising extremist group that the people there have. The reporters very concerned about the rise of extremism, how that might affect. They've seen slowly over time the use of hijab, which is the head covering. Years ago, almost no women did that. And now, really, it's everywhere. And so this concerns. Religion writers writing about this. And it's a country to watch for sure because it's huge.
You visited an Islamic boarding school there, one of like tens of thousands, I guess, they have there that kind of offers a glimpse of what Islam is like in the country. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this school in South Jakarta that we went to, interestingly, of course, the female reporters were required to wear head covering, including me. It was kind of funny to see myself that way. But so the female students do wear hijab, and all the classes are separated by gender. But they're learning English. The girls and boys have exactly the same curriculum, and they don't learn any kind of anti-American feelings. They don't. Some of their graduates actually study in the U.S. There's a high emphasis on computer skills, technology, social media, which is pretty interesting. They're much less isolated than some other Islamic schools in the country. And so they see themselves as kind of modern and progressive. And it was pretty fascinating to watch Muslim Boy Scouts, Muslim Girl Scouts, Muslim girls drumming and having a marching band and swimming. And it was a pretty interesting place, I thought.
There's a great video at sltrip.com that it's not real long, but if you look at it, it gives you a flavor of what life is like at that school. Of course, this is Mormon land, so tell us about Mormonism in Indonesia, the most Muslim country in the world.
Well, one thing, I don't think Utahns understand what a tiny, tiny, tiny little presence Mormonism is in this Muslim nation. We asked our hosts, so what do the average Indonesian think about Mormonism? And he said, I would say 99 out of 100 people have never heard of it. Maybe 999 out of 1,000 have not heard of it. And the only one thing they might possibly know about Mormonism is that it once practiced polygamy. And in fact, most of them thought it still practices polygamy. Since we talked to the editor of the Jakarta Post, who's Muslim and on the board of our organization, he said, yeah, we watched Big Love. And I said, oh, no. He said, yeah, that's Mormon, right? And we tried to explain, well, kind of Mormon. They perceive themselves as Mormon, but it's definitely an offshoot. The big church no longer practices polygamy. But that was very hard to explain to someone on the other side of the world who, you know, that there's little offshoots. The only way we could explain it to him is to say, you know, there's various forms of Islam also, and some of them, even in Indonesia, are sort of persecuted by the big group of Muslims in Indonesia are Sunnis. So Shias, there are plenty of Shias, but that would be a minority group, and they are not often favored. And so I tried to explain, so there's the big Mormon church, and then there's these little offshoots, but it was pretty interesting.
Well, within American culture, I mean, people have heard of Mormons now, but they still are sort of viewed as odd or unusual, especially within the Christian tradition. So I guess what's better, to not know anything about Mormonism or to just, think, oh, they're Big Love, you know? That's for the Mormons who practice in Indonesia.
Yeah, that's been hard, having to explain that they don't practice polygamy, because Indonesia is a place where polygamy is legal, because Muslims allow polygamy. Interestingly, Mormons and Muslims in Indonesia get along really well. Mormons have been involved in some humanitarian efforts there, and they're at sort of governmental level, there's some respect. The people, as you bring up, Jen, the people that really oppose Mormonism in Indonesia are other Christians who are kind of behind the, by the way, they still practice polygamy notion. And they're also the ones who sometimes say, oh, Mormons are a false sect. Other Christians are some of the ones who have opposed Mormons trying to build chapels. In order to build a church structure, you have to have the approval of 60 of your neighbors. And there's been opposition to every single one of their attempts to build chapels. So there's about a little over 7,000 Mormons in a country of 260 million.
Wow.
Wow. So it's small.
We did the math, 35,000 to one, actually a little bit more than 35,000 to one.
Yeah. And there's, what did we say, 24 wards or branches, mm-hmm. two stakes. That's it, spread out over this whole country.
Are LDS missionaries allowed within Indonesia?
Yes, there are missionaries there. There are 70, I think. I think we said 70. Was told to me by a Mormon public affairs person there, but they are not allowed to go door to door. So really, all they and about half of them are Indonesian, which helps. But they're not allowed to go door to door. They mostly can talk to people on the street, or no street displays or anything like that, but they can talk to folks in taxi cabs or on the buses. It's hard. I think it's very, very hard for them.
People can convert there, though, right?
I mean,
it's not outlawed, but there are some things that make it difficult to be a Mormon there, I guess you could say.
There, conversion is allowed, which is very unusual for a Muslim nation. Lots of places you could be killed for converting to another faith. In Indonesia, it's permitted, but you have to marry within your own faith. So if a Christian wants to marry a Muslim, one or the other of them has to convert to the other faith. And so sometimes those conversions are on paper only. You know, they say, oh, okay, now I'm Muslim, but no one really checks up on that.
So they still attend Mormon services or whatever.
They could still attend Mormon services or Christian services, whatever. No one's checking up. But on the marriage certificate itself, they have to be of the same faith.
Given the how outnumbered, I guess you could say, what kind of community have the Mormons built there? Do they tend to still associate with everybody else? Do they try to see their Mormon, you know, colleagues more often?
Yeah, the strength. One of the strengths of Mormonism is creating a sense of community. And one thing, many of the Protestant churches there, or the Catholic churches, come from the same ethnic tribe, if you will, the same ethnicity. Whereas Mormonism, and most of the people who become Mormon over there are drawn from Christian backgrounds. Some are Muslim converts, but many are Christians. But they're drawn from various ethnic groups. And these little Mormon wards and branches become very close-knit, to the point where they celebrate holidays together. They our guide told us that they also celebrate Indonesian holidays at their Mormon wards, which I loved. Mm-hmm. They celebrate Indonesian independence at their Mormon branch, whatever. So that's interesting. But I think that strength of Mormonism in creating community is pretty strong there. There's very much a family feel.
Is there a difference in the actual meetings or the practice? I mean, you hear a lot about Utah Mormons and how they're sort of a unique thing. I'm just wondering how that translates into Indonesia.
I didn't go to church there, but our guide did tell us that they're pretty similar to American Mormonism in terms of the schedule, the three-hour block, etc. But there are some cultural traditions from Indonesia that they try to implement, and sometimes come in conflict with American Mormonism. One little example was how one leader wanted to celebrate Christmas at church, which
on Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day, whether it's Sunday or not, which is unusually, I mean, that's not how Mormons do it in the U.S., which is kind of funny. But he was told no, they couldn't do that. And Another cultural tradition, a cultural practice in Indonesia is, you know, people get paid for all kinds of different little services. We were there when there was a huge traffic jam, and our driver, our guide, just a guy popped out of his car and directed traffic, and our guy just rolled down the window and gave him some money. And that's just how it's done there. So in America, it seems sometimes like bribes, but to them, it's really just the way things are done and
cost of living.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't seem wrong. And so there's some of those little traditions, I think, that are difficult and different.
Can we leave behind Indonesia for a bit? You also went to Vietnam. Now, you had a previous Mormon land where you talked with the mission president.
I did,
in Vietnam. And, of course, Vietnam has this history in American minds. We fought a bloody war there. It cost tens of thousands of American lives and millions of Vietnamese lives. How is this U.S.-born faith perceived in Vietnam? Budding faith, very small.
So interesting. There really is, according to the mission president, very little remaining hostility to the U.S., despite the fact that we killed their relatives and many, many, many refugees left Vietnam for the U.S. and Europe. But the mission president told me, listen, it was 40 years ago, and many of the young people today have no real thoughts about it, maybe the way Americans might think about Germans. There just isn't hostility, and there is kind of, in some ways, an admiration for the U.S. And one thing that is very attractive to people in Vietnam is Mormon missionary. I mean, the LDS Church has set up a mission there, so there are some missionaries.
And it's in Hanoi.
Where the mission headquarters is, right, in Hanoi. But there are missionaries throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And one thing they do, like a lot of places, is English classes. And that's free English classes. And lots of Vietnamese trying to learn English and trying to improve their lot by knowing English. And that could be the opening to get into people's, draw attention to the LDS Church. Another thing was so interesting in Vietnam was that, so it was a Buddhist country and then a kind of communist, atheistic society, though there are still plenty of Catholics. But something a lot of people of whatever background believe in, ancestor veneration. So ancestor veneration, it might not be the thing that people are looking for, but when Vietnamese find the church and they see that Mormons believe in work for the dead and for dead ancestors, they instantly connect to that ancestor veneration, speaking to the dead, and it becomes this common vocabulary that they have that is very appealing. And and it also helps them with their relatives who are upset that they might be joining this little known, unknown American sect. But when relatives who join say, but look, Mom and Dad, they believe the same kind of things you do, then it helps, I think, blunt some of the criticism of their having joined.
And what is the church membership in Vietnam? I mean, is it as minuscule as you saw in Indonesia? Or?
Well, it's super small, but there aren't as many people in Vietnam as there are in Indonesia. So it would be a smaller, I think there are about 5,000 members. And there are a lot of members more on the books who joined like in the 70s or so, and then they went, they fled Vietnam, went to Cambodia, joined there, and then they come back. So there's a lot of records of people who have joined but are lost. Mm. So they're searching.
You talked about someone going through the records to try to find people who fled during the fighting and the fall of, say, Saigon and all those things, right?
And the way you find them, I guess, is you go to these villages where people know each other in those villages. They even know, you know, people who were there before. And so they're able to kind of track some of those folks. Another thing that's really was really interesting to me about Vietnam, talking to the mission president, was that you think about all the people that left Vietnam, came to the U.S., came to Europe, and raised their families here. And Mormonism has had missions. I always thought this was so odd. They've had missions like the Texas Vietnamese-speaking mission. You're called to Dallas Vietnamese-speaking, or Oakland, California Vietnamese-speaking, or Georgia or Florida. Well, now children of those refugees are being called back to Vietnam. So they might already speak the language, but the mission president said not only do they speak it, they are culturally sensitive, so you can send them right into these villages, and they don't have to have cultural sensitivity training like the Caucasians do. So that was interesting. Hanoi is a very thriving city. Lots and lots of motorbikes and a rising economy. Lots of interesting places there.
Is there an LDS temple there?
Oh, no. No. That's far in the future. I mean, they just barely opened the mission this year.
Uh-huh.
So their nearest temple, I think, is Manila. I think that I talked to some people who went to Manila to...
Closer than Hong Kong?
And some went to Hong Kong. But I think, as I recall, it's a... You know, it's a funny thing because there were members, the mission president himself was a missionary in 1974 who was evacuated in 1975 with the fall of Saigon. So there were those early Latter-day Saints, but only a hundred or so were left after the evacuation. And so you think of it as being a new, young church compared to, say, Hong Kong or the Philippines, which has very mature members and a mature church. This is a new church, but it does have some old long-time members. And they're
pioneers.
They're finding more, and then these descendants are building. So maybe there'll be a temple there someday.
Now, you were in Vietnam on a Sunday, so you were able to go to a service. How did it feel like you were at a Mormon service?
Oh, totally. Yes, it did. It felt exact. The one thing, the building itself was a four-story building in the middle of a block. So from the outside, you would never notice. And it had a Vietnamese flag on the outside. So you never think, oh, this is a Mormon church. But you go in, elevator doors open, and there's the, you know, fluorescent lighting, there's the white walls, there's the missionaries with the name tags, just white shirts. It looked so much like any Mormon ward house I've ever been in, though small.
Familiar art.
Yeah, familiar art, though not a lot of art. But talks. The one thing that was a little different than I'm used to in Utah is that they had translation headsets, because some people, there's obviously the branch ward where we went, there were only about 24 or so people, and almost half of those were senior couples or missionaries. And so some people don't speak Vietnamese, they speak only English. Some people speak only Vietnamese, they don't speak English. Two talks that day were given in English, so all the Vietnamese had to have headsets, and they were translated by the branch president, who is a professional translator, and he's employed by the church. So that was interesting. But he and his wife, especially he, was severely chastised by his family for joining. To the point where, and you forget this, but he lives with his parents, that he and his wife and child live.
Oh, that's awkward.
With his parents. I guess they have lots of intergenerational living situations like that, because it's expensive to have your own place. He did not tell his parents he was joining the LDS Church. His dad found his baptism record in his backpack and had to say, whoa, what is this? And he was almost, he and his wife and child were almost, they were kind of kicked out, but then the place where they were trying to move fell through, so they had to move back in with the parents, and it's been rough. But he said eventually they're slowly seeing that he's still the same and that he's a good person. Mm. But hard. These are hard family relationship things that we saw there in Vietnam.
You went to two other countries, and I'm sort of going to skim over them because you haven't written about them, and I don't want to scoop your stories. But you did go to Hong Kong and to the Philippines. Can you give us just some general observations of what you saw and what Mormons look like in those countries?
Yeah, that was, as I mentioned, both of those places, Hong Kong and the Philippines, are mature, what we would call mature church things, units. The in Hong Kong, well, both of those places, I was intrigued by gender relations. And so in Hong Kong, there happened to be some all-women wards, which I'm not going to tell you more about it, but it's...
Wouldn't see that here, though, would you?
No. No, you wouldn't.
Interesting.
But to its credit, the LDS Church has adapted to the needs of some of these women and created these units. Philippines, also kind of a matriarchal society, and so lots of women breadwinners, and how that, what kind of impact that has on church structure, church programs. That was pretty fascinating.
How's that for a teaser?
Yeah, more to come, right?
We can't wait to hear those stories. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, one distinguishing fact about Mormons is that they have this unique health code that we've talked about before. How does that translate into a Muslim or a Buddhist nation where tea is sort of like your world revolves around it, and other, you know, alcohol consumption, things like that are much more common practice?
Well, I don't know so much about tea in those places, but I can definitely tell you about liquor laws. Because in Islam, Muslims forbid the drinking of alcohol. So you have a place like Indonesia, okay, most populous Muslim nation. And again, very tolerant place. And so they do not have a ban on liquor, except for they did ban... A couple of years ago, just 2015, they banned the sale of it in little mini marts. So that was difficult, kind of took the sale down about 13%. But then there are provinces, like there's one province that's really rigidly Muslim, and they don't allow it. And then there's another province that's all Hindu. That's Bali. And Bali relies completely on tourism. They cannot outlaw alcohol in Bali. That would be devastating to the economy. But just this year, they're again, with the rising extremism, there's legislation in front of the, I guess I would call it national or federal legislation outlawing it. So wait and see. But then Malaysia, nearby Malaysia, is Muslim and does forbid alcohol to be sold to any Muslim in Malaysia. So
what about Mormons? It's not forbidden to be sold to a Mormon?
Apparently not. And it's not forbidden to be sold to a Muslim visitor. So if someone is in the country not from Malaysia, they have to show their passport to show that they're not from Malaysia then. But if a waiter sells alcohol to a Malaysian Muslim, the waiter will be arrested.
Wow.
Wow, makes Utah liquor laws look liberal, doesn't it?
In Pakistan, only members of non-Muslim minorities, such as Hindus, Christians, and presumably Muslims, can buy or sell liquor. And the they have a certain quota. They have maybe 5 bottles of liquor per couple of months, and these are Christians, Hindus, etc. So they sell it on the black market to Muslims. So it's just like, it was fascinating to hear how these countries adapt to these laws, how they deal with, you know, I guess in Pakistan, there's a pretty thriving black market among Christians to sell to Muslims. And I was utterly fascinated by that, given Utah.
Well, as Dave mentioned, you know, Mormonism is an American-born faith, but it does like to perceive itself as a global religion. Your observations would verify that, I guess, that growing consciousness of a worldwide church?
I'd have to say my observation at this point is that it's an American church with international members. Not yet a global faith, but it does have in its pool of doctrines, if you will, lots of aspects that connect, like that ancestor veneration aspect that connects with people around the globe. And I guess I'm going to predict that as it goes forward, maybe some of those aspects and those members will help it eventually become a more global faith. But that would have to mean that the American headquarters would maybe have to let go of some of its control or bring in some of those regional leaders to be bigger players in how it's described in the missionary system or how it's promoted. For that to happen. Currently, like I said, you go to church in Vietnam and you feel like you're in Bountiful or somewhere like that. And maybe that will always be the case, and maybe there's nothing wrong with that, but maybe in the future it might adapt a little bit more to regional differences.
So doctrinally, you feel like there's things in Mormonism that are global, can appeal globally.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's more of policy or even cultural traditions,
yeah,
that might need to be adapted for everyone to feel at home in Mormonism. We know LDS leaders travel the world,
right?
You know, so they certainly see and are aware of these things, but they're not from there,
right?
So you'd think like that could help change that if
there
were more influence from.
I think that's probably changing a little bit, but I don't know how long it's going to take to do that. But yeah.
Well, if anyone's going to see those changes, it will be you. Peggy Fletcher Stack, thank you very much for sharing your travel stories with us.
My pleasure.
And you can read lots more online, sltrib.com. For Dave Noyce, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Tune in next time for Mormonland. Thanks.